Today is July the 26th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and I'm in the studio of PRN.FM. My colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, that's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio Eastern Time, at and the program is live. Stream on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our website is PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will continue to be available on PRN.FM. Tonight, WBAI is in a membership drive, but I'll be on at 9 p.m. with a different program. And it's a beautiful day in New York, and I think I want to try something different today. We have a call-in line, and the number is 888-874-4888. Let me repeat that, 888-874-4888. And the reason why I give out that number is there's two pieces of news that is quite important, and I think some of you may have some reaction to it. Let me talk about the first one, and that's the fact that Microsoft is changing their update policy. You know, it used to be that with Microsoft, they would release an operating system, and they would say, well, there's at least, you get changes on it for 5 years, and there's also at least 5 years of security changes, to the operating system on the piece of hardware you bought. Well, they started playing around with that, and what now they're saying is that, well, you know what? If you upgraded to Windows 10 or you bought a machine with Windows 10 on it, and you happen to have, there's two different processors. If you happen to have those processors, one is called... actually, they're all Atom processors. They will no longer support it. Now, wait a minute. Now, you know, you buy something, you expect it to be supported. So what they're saying is that in the case of the Atom chip, what they're saying is that the Atom Z2580 and the Clover Trail processor, if you try to upgrade it to Windows 10 because you're running maybe Windows 7 or 8 or 8.1 on it, and by the way, those processors were used in the selling of equipment from 2011 to 2015, so that's about a year and a half, 2 years ago, you can't upgrade it. Hey, let me tell you what, there is a workaround. I'm going to tell you how to do it. They said that you cannot upgrade it if you go online to upgrade. You don't have to go online. You could just find from other sources. There are two versions of Windows 10 that will upgrade your Windows 7 or 8 or 8.1 to Windows 10 if you happen to have the processors, the Z2580 or the Clover Trail CPU. What you do is you find yourself a copy of Windows 10 build number 1511. And the other one is build number 1607. 1511 refers to the initial release of Windows 10, November 2015. That's how they get the 1511. And the 1607 was the upgrade to it. It was the 1 year anniversary, I guess. And that means that it was released in 2016 in July. If you can't find it, send me some email, and I'll tell you where you can go get it. And by the way, our website is pcradioshow.org, and just say Hank at pcradioshow.org, and let me know. And you may have some thoughts about that. And you know what? With Microsoft, we said they giveth and they take it. Okay, what they've been trying to do is get everyone to go over to Windows 10. Now, I don't know. If you try to go to Windows 10 now, if you happen to have those two processors, whether it will work or not, but, I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. Now, how do you know you have it? Well, many people don't realize that if you boot up your existing system, go to Control Panel, go to System, and right on that splash page, right in the middle, it tells you what that processor is. So let me just repeat that again. Control Panel, System, and right in the middle of it, it not only tells you the processor that you're running with, but it also tells you the version of the operating system you're running. And by the way, there are at least four different versions in the upgrade. And you have to make sure that if you do download it, you download the right one. There's the 32-bit version of Home. There's a 64-bit version of Home. There is the 32-bit version of Pro. And there is the 64-bit version of Home and Pro. So you got four different versions of Windows 10, and you have to do a one-for-one match. In other words, if you're running with Windows 7 32-bit operating system, it doesn't matter if it's a 32-bit hard piece of hardware, but if you have a 32-bit operating system, you have to match up the operating system. You have any questions on it, just give me a call on 888-874-4888. And that's a lesson to be learned. Anytime people give you something, you got to be a little wary of it. And talking about, getting something, Microsoft announced that starting in the third quarter, or they say in the fourth, which is the third quarter, part of the third quarter and fourth quarter, they're going to be eliminating some of the features in Windows 10. Now, wait a minute. You mean there are features in Windows 10 they're going to eliminate and they had it originally? Well, what are they? Well, it turns out that there are three features that they will be eliminating. One happens to be Paint. Now, I use Paint regularly, when I help people out, when I try to get something on the screen, I find that if I hold down the Windows button and then hit Print Screen, it creates a JPEG file automatically into the picture folder, and I could just save that and read it out in Paint. Well, is there a workaround? Yeah, but the only thing is a workaround means you got to download a program ahead of time. There are many programs that you can download to give you the equivalent of Paint. Although this is not Paint, but it will perform the functions of Paint for what you may want to use it for. I use Irfan View. That's IRFANVIEW. And it does a heck of a lot more than just, changing pixel colors and so on. But, that's a shame, because if you're helping someone out, you don't want to go through the trouble of saying, oh, I got to put this program on or that program on. The other thing that they're going to start removing in terms of making it available is Outlook Express. Now, some people will say, wait a minute. There's a difference between Outlook and Outlook Express. Outlook Express is readily available in the operating system when it was released. Outlook is, although the word is, they gave it the same name, and that's they're really cute about that. Outlook is part of the Office package, and it has a lot more than just email. It's got contact lists and so on. Hey, listen, you can get around that. Now, what Outlook Express does is that instead of using regular webmail, in other words, all your mail is on a website, and you look at the mail, and you could look at it from different machines, and you could edit on it, but it's all on the server. What Outlook Express does, it allows you to download all your email to your local machine, and then you don't have to be on the internet. You could then take your sweet time and edit the read your messages and responses, and then send everything back. But there are replacements for that. But there's a third feature that none of the journalists, when they write about it, they only talk about those two features being eliminated in the third quarter. But there's a feature that I think is very important. And I happen to find out about it because I don't go to the journals to find out what's being eliminated. I go straight to Microsoft or wherever, whoever the publisher, the government, to get the information. Take the time out to read it. If you don't understand it, ask someone. But they are eliminating SIB, System Image Backup. I said, whoa, wait a minute. What's my mantra? Backup, backup, backup. And they're eliminating what? System Image Backup? Yeah, what they're saying is they're recommending that you get a third-party piece of software. Now, there's a lot available, and I'll mention that, okay? But then they're also saying, Hey, use the Microsoft Cloud. Come on. You know what? Microsoft has grown very rapidly in 1 year to be almost number one in cloud support. And the reason why is because they have moved much of their software, like Office and so on. It's software as a service, SaaS. In other words, it's sort of like, you know, if you want to use a Office 365, it's like, what, $5, $10 a month. And, you know, it's a little, you know, little dollars here and there, but they add up. And they encourage you to use the cloud to store your documents. Hey, I you know what? It works. Why am I always reticent about it? It's because there are many cloud services that when you start off, and we've been talking about it, you put your data there, and sometimes without any warning at all, they say, we're eliminating it. Or, by the way, it's $400 a year. Or, by the way, we have new restrictions. I like to be able to control my own destiny. So if you have any comments on that, it's 888-874-4888. And I guess if you're all driving, you know what? Hold off on it. I don't want you to be driving and talking on your cell phone at the same time. But that's you know, those two things are sort of like, well, Microsoft is, that's their new marketing. Now, there's another piece of item that that was released that I find it to be very interesting. And that had to do with, I would call, you know, people are talking about, you know, what programming language should I learn? Very simple. It's where is the job? In other words, you know, there was a study that was done, and let me just pull it out. And the study basically says, what software is in demand? Well, it turns out that there are two sources for it. One is that the software, if it's for at the consumer level, in other words, let me say that in the market, they always break it down into the consumer level, the hobbyist level, you know, the people in the home, maybe even the small office, and then the enterprise level. Well, the enterprise is big corporation, S&P 500, or whatever you want to call it. In other words, the people that gets the real applications done, I guess. And they're saying that at the consumer level, the number one programming language is Python. And it turns out that enterprise, that's not the number one programming language. The number one programming language is Java. Now, that's a little confusing because Microsoft has played games with, again, words. Java and JavaScript, you probably heard that term JavaScript, they're not the same product, okay? And that's very misleading. But Java is it's really a network programming language so that you, when you write it, it's very portable if it's running on the network. And with Python, if you want to learn it, it's very easy. It's very, very low cost. It's a native language of the Raspberry Pi. And you could download the language very easily, and there's a whole lot of stuff that you can play with. I think that was a week or 2 weeks ago, I talked about the fact that Microsoft, one of the engineers were playing game with Python, and he started developing a artificial intelligence module program. That'll be fun to play with. But, you know, when we talk about programming, there are two aspects to programming, and most people don't realize it. When I started, there was what is called programming, and then there is what is called coding. Programming is really the thought process of how do you organize and how do you structure and how do you build something, whereas coding is you're building it, okay? This is almost like the architect is the programming part of it, and the people pouring the cement and, you know, putting in the building blocks, you know, in a building, that's the coding part of it. The coding part is, well, it's specific to what materials you're using. So in this case, it's the language itself. Now, in terms of languages, if you happen to be a, there are people that can do both. There are people that can give you, you know, they're very good in design and concept and coming up with different ways of doing something, the development of a different algorithm to do it. That is what is called programming. Unfortunately, programming and coding is now treated as if it's one and the same, and people would, you know, they would say, what program should I learn? Well, I think it's more important to understand the concepts of design, the concepts of how do you do architectural design, because coding is really it's laborious. It's someone gives you the steps by step. It's like painting, by the numbers. Okay, that to me is coding. Programming is I give you a blank sheet and I would like you to do a scene, but it's a blank sheet. Now do it. Well, that's the difference. And which language should you use if you want to get into programming? Simple. Look in your area. Look at the areas that you want to work in. Look at the companies and find out what they're using, what languages they're using. And that's one way of doing it. And if you don't know, I tell you what I would do, okay? I would probably start off with Python because it's a cheap entry and it's a way of getting onto it. There was another piece of news that I think that was quite important that when I first heard about it, I said, Joe, did you hear that O'Reilly Associates, they're not printing books anymore? He says, wait a minute now. O'Reilly has a series of books. They're great, okay, where basically almost on any technical subject, in other words, this is really a technical manual, and, They had excellent. I think one of their good series was the Nutshell. The Nutshell of this, the Nutshell of that. It's very well written, and it makes it easy to learn some technology, and it's basically they're the preeminent publisher as far as I'm concerned of tech titles for non dummies, and but they're going to stop printing. However, these books will be made available as ebooks. So that's the good news. Why? Because it shifted. In the technology we have, everything has become disruptive. We've changed the way we do things, and Amazon is a good example where they've affected retailing. And now some of the stuff that they announce, it causes other companies, because not that they did anything wrong, but their stock price would take a big dramatic drop. But one of the things that I like to tell everyone to be aware of is that Amazon is no different than Apple. Just because they enter a field, just because they develop a product, just because they develop a service, doesn't mean it's going to be successful. It's not. There's no guarantee of it. Now, you could say, well, most of the time they are successful with it. And when they're successful, they're very successful. Because one of the things that Amazon announced was that they were buying out Whole Foods. And I'm saying to myself, okay, on something that's a dry good, it's, you know, that's a product that you know, it's not going to change. You know, that's fine. But you ever try to buy a fish online? Come on. You could say, okay, I want to buy a tuna or I want to buy salmon. Hey, I like to look at the fish, you know, lift up the gills, see how fresh it is, look at the eyes. Same thing with fruits. You want to touch it to see how hard or soft it is, smell it, see if there's any aroma or fragrance to it. I just don't buy this bit where, you know, you could, treat food like a pair of shoes, you know. Like with a pair of shoes, if it doesn't quite fit, well, you send it back and you get another pair. But food is different. Food is it's edible. There's a perishable life to it. So you just can't do that. And I understand that Amazon is being investigated by the government because they had a big push on their Prime and everything being discounted. And of course, there's a difference, opinion on it. One tracking company said that over 60% of the so-called discounted products with the Prime sales were above the selling price before it went on sale. Wait a minute. Over 60% of the products were priced above the sale price before they went on sale? That's not a sale at all. I suspect that what they did was they took a sampling and did some extrapolation on it. How much of it? I don't know. Do they mean to do it? I don't know. But, hey, that's Amazon, and, you know, that is something they're doing. And, well, who knows, okay? By the way, on the second half of the hour, we normally do we feature some segments, and let me just comment on that a little. And the reason why I want to do, normally I would just tell you what they are, but in this half today, we in the half hour, we have the wearable and health technology segment that Dr. Alfred Poor talks about, and he gave me his what he's going to talk about, and I was fascinated by one of the items he covers, a sixth finger. In other words, a wearable device that gives you six fingers on your hand. And the sixth finger is a thumb that gives you two thumbs. And I'm saying to myself, now, we normally think of wearable tech and health technology as replacing something that you have because of a disability or injury and so on. But this one is a little different. This is augmenting it. Now, if you happen to have two thumbs, would you hold a baseball a little differently? Would you have any advantage? Are they going to say, wait a minute, you can't have six fingers. You're throwing the baseball a little differently. Or in the case of in other sports, you may say, you can't do that. It's fascinating to think about it. And then the other thing is you have to listen to it, okay? He's talking about the ability to connect to the human brain. Now, I realize it's quite primitive and it's something that's new, but I think it was written up in the New York Times. What it means is that there are people who can't speak or for any reason, but the brain is active. How do they communicate? A good example is Hawking's, okay? He does it a little differently. Now, can you imagine if you can connect a wearable or health technology device to the human brain and it's able to interpret what the human brain is trying to say, and then you can manipulate objects or be able to express it in a certain way? Hey, I thought it's a fun subject. And I have a segment in the second half. Because, school, for many areas, school graduation was in May in colleges, and in high school is in June. And you know, they're out of school now, just, what, 2-3 weeks? And all of a sudden now, hey, wait a minute, back to school already they're talking about? And they're talking about the electronics. Well, I give a guideline on what type of electronics you should look at, what you should consider buying. And I also did a product review on a multifunction unit. What I mean by multifunction? Well, multifunction today is print, copy, and scan. By the way, with the modern multifunction unit, there's no more fax capability. And the reason why is because you need a real phone line, a VoIP line, VoIP landline. That's not really a landline. It's a virtual landline. So no more of that. And then I asked Marty Winston, I said to him, you know, we talk about backup, and backup, but, we talk about hardware backup, software backup. What about the power source itself? We should really consider that. And last week I talked about Fios, the backup battery. It's a phony backup. In other words, it just backs up a beep and it doesn't give you really a telephone backup unless you have the ability to, get that phone up and running. Does not give you internet backup. It does not give you TV backup. But the battery costs anywhere from $50 to $100 to replace when the energy is expended. And then I took it to task because, well, very simple. It's a 12-volt wet cell. Now, what kind of design is that? So I said to Marty, hey, listen, you can replace it with a UPS. He says, you sure can. I said, yeah, but you know what? You could buy a UPS for for about $20, all right? And you could buy a UPS for like $200. What's the difference? Oh, yeah, there are differences. So I asked him, hey, you know what? We're going to educate the public on that. So we're going to get to that. And I just want to let everyone know that if you have any questions, You could send me email at hank@pcradioshow.org. And I hope that, you know, if anyone is bashful about, you know, getting on the phone to call 888-874-4888, tell you what, send me a piece of email, talk to me, and maybe I'll call you if that can help at all. So we're going to now get on to this last half of the show. No sooner had July 4th ended with all the special promotional sales, the merchants are pushing another event. But this one does not have a specific date because they cannot wait till Labor Day to push for another big sales day. This one is called Back to School, and there's no set date for it, so expect it to run until Labor Day. We will address electronic support for those who are going back to school or starting college for the first time. According to the National Retail Federation's annual survey, consumer spending on back-to-school and back-to-college spending will be at or near an all-time high. Total spending is expected to reach $83 billion this year, a more than 10% increase over the $75 billion spent last year. 60% of all back-to-school shoppers plan to purchase electronics, spending a total of almost $9 billion, a little more than 10% of the overall spending on back-to-school items. The average consumer will spend roughly $205 on electronics. Consumers were asked what type of electronics they plan to purchase. Among the most sought-after products were laptops, cited by 45% of consumers, tablets, 35%, and calculators, 35%. A 25% of respondents identified electronic accessories like a mouse, flash drive, or charger as items they would purchase. Schools are changing their classroom technology to include laptops and tablets. What laptop or tablet should a new college student buy? Check first with the college what equipment and operating systems are supported. The school will be your first line of defense when support such as installation and when tech help is needed. Hold off on software purchase. Most schools have software licensing agreement with major publishers in which student copies are available for a very modest charge. For those who will be living in a dorm, space will be at a premium. And if you are a commuting student, a lightweight laptop with high usage time between battery recharge is very important. To avoid conflict over available AC outlets for equipment charging, many schools have but one AC outlet in the classroom available for use by the professor or instructor. In the 70s and 80s, students brought to school boomboxes or hi-fi stereo components. These items take up premium space in the dorm room. Today, this has been replaced by the smartphone with high-end headphones. Just check that the smartphone has telephone coverage for home and the location of the school. The selected smartphone should also have FM available and the carrier has not disabled its reception. Almost all schools today have a campus printer output center. However, I recommend the purchase of a compact printer for use in dorm room, so the option for print is always available when needed 24/7, especially when you are doing overnight cramming and the campus computing center is closed. Overall, cost of electronic equipment support is small compared to today's cost for tuition, room, and board. We have been told the PC industry is dying. It's phasing out. Well, what a surprise. Sales are expected to be up. Long live the king. The following is a review of a multifunction unit that is rather nondescript. There's nothing fancy about it. It's not very fast in operation. It's very basic in operation of print, copy, and scan. However, what makes it interesting is that it is a very compact physical unit that can fit small spaces and it can operate in a variety of communication modes, which includes connecting to smartphones, Chromebooks, Windows-based systems, Mac OS X systems. In fact, there are other modes of operation that makes it very interesting. The following is a review of the Epson Expression Home XP440 all-in-one system. Like all modern-day multifunction units, you can print, copy, and scan.
A card reader is built in, so a computer does not have to be used with the unit. It is a compact unit at very low cost. Street price of the unit with sales tax and shipping, where it's applicable, ranges from anywhere from $50 to $60. So what sets this apart from other units other than price? The unit, when not in use, occupies 15.4 inches by 11.8 inches of desktop space. The height of the unit is 5.7 inches, which makes it slightly larger than the Olivetti portable typewriter I used for term papers. Since the unit weighs 9.5 pounds when not in use, it can easily be stowed away in a closet and taken out when needed, so an outlet is the only thing you need to get it up and running again. In addition to being able to connect with a standard USB cable, which is not supplied, there is wireless connectivity on the Epson XP440, and it supports iOS, Android, Windows, Apple AirPrint, Google Cloud Print, Fire OS, and other protocols. Text print quality is excellent. Photograph tonal print quality is natural. The ability to do edge-to-edge printing is a plus, and I was pleasantly surprised that with a drop gravity paper feed, it can print onto 8.5 inch by 42 inch paper, creating banners. A critical test of photographic quality is the total absence of striation marks on solid colors. The Epson XP440 does this with flying colors. At this price, don't expect speed. It takes about 15 seconds to print a sheet of text material. Duplex or double-sided printing is not available. It takes about a full minute or more to print a full-size page photograph. The build quality of the unit is acceptable. The XP440 uses four ink cartridges. Online cartridge replacement is readily available, ranging from $5.50 to $6 per cartridge. The print capacity of the standard cartridge is about 175 pages. Extra capacity cartridges are available. This is a recommended printer for student use or home use where the volume use is light. As always, you should have an extra set of cartridges on hand, such as that when replacement is needed, you don't have to run around trying to get replacement ink cartridges.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. One of the features that sets humans and other apes apart from the rest of the animals is our opposable thumb. This works at right angles to our fingers and gives us the ability to grasp things and throw them and hammer with them and so forth, tasks that are much more difficult for animals that don't have this kind of feature. So what does that have to do with wearable technology? Well, let me ask you this. What could you do if you had a sixth finger on your hand? Not only a sixth finger, but make it a second thumb. It would be located over by your little finger, opposite your regular thumb. In fact, researchers in London have developed just such a device. It's a prosthetic thumb that straps onto your hand, located next to your little finger, and it's attached to a band that you wear on your wrist, which contains the motors and the actuators required to cause it to move. It's connected by a wireless Bluetooth connection to a smartphone. There's a wireless sensor that you put in your shoe, and the amount of pressure that you put down with your foot determines how hard that second thumb will squeeze when you're picking something up. It's kind of a cool idea. Could give you a stronger grasp. It could create new possibilities. I know that guitar players might be very interested in having an extra finger available to them while they're playing. Who knows, maybe athletes like baseball pitchers or cricket bowlers could come up with some new pitches if they had an extra thumb on the other side of their hand. So here we have an example of wearable technology not to replace a damaged or missing function of the body, but actually to augment the human body and provide new functions, new features. It's an interesting approach, and it'll be interesting to see if this develops into something useful for various applications in the future. Well, from a second thumb, we're now proceeding to sort of a new brain interface. Now, one of the problems that we have with the human brain is that it's extremely complex and it communicates with the rest of the body in many important ways. It receives signals from various sensing kinds of organs, the eyes, the ears, and so forth. And at the same time, it also exerts control over all your muscles and other body parts. If for some reason the connection between the brain and the body gets damaged, we can lose vision, we can lose motor control, we become paralyzed. And so a lot of research that goes into this brain-body connection to find ways to help reconnect the disconnected brain. Now, a company called Paradromics is working on a novel approach to this whole brain interface. A lot of companies and researchers have experimented by putting sensors and electrodes and attach them to the brain to try to detect signals in the brain. But the thing is, it's a fairly low bandwidth. There's not a lot of information that can flow back and forth. The contacts don't cover a whole lot of the brain. What this company is working on is what they call the neural input-output bus. And the idea is to be able to connect a million neurons at one time. Now, the problem here is, if you're getting data to or from a million neurons at one time, you have to move a lot of data very quickly in parallel. Now, most digital communication devices these days work in serial. So the data is sent down a single connection very fast, but all the data is contained in a single wire or a couple wires. The brain works in parallel, where all these signals are sent simultaneously down many channels all at once. And so the challenge here is to design a system that will take this massively parallel data stream and convert it into a digital stream that can be detected by a computer and the data analyzed and processed and put to use. The way this company works is they're using special CMOS chips, very, very tiny, and microwire bundles, so millions of wires in this tiny little bundle. They're then able to spread the implant connection with the brain over a larger area and be able to gather information from a larger portion of the brain from more neurons. This is a program that sounds a little science fictionist, but it's one of the programs that's being backed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of a new program called the Neural Engineering System Design Program. It's one of a number of projects that are being funded to try to help improve the interface between the brain and digital devices. The obvious connection is that this could reconnect portions of the brain to sensors, so it could restore sight, it could restore hearing. Going the other direction, it may be able to provide motor control, so somebody who's paralyzed may be able to regain control of their muscles and their body. But another whole area where this could be used is to provide a brain-device interface. So, for example, somebody who's in a paralyzed state to the point where they can't communicate with anybody outside because they don't have any control over their body, it's quite possible that in the future we may be able to sense the activity in the brain and use that so that we can communicate with people who are otherwise apparently in a coma or something like that, but who still have brain activity. This could be a massive gain for people and very important. It's an interesting case where we're going to be able to augment the natural abilities of people and maybe restore damage that would otherwise leave them paralyzed or disabled for life. So from the sort of science fiction wiring our brains to communicate with the rest of the world, we'll go now to a fairly more mundane kind of topic about health tech. One of the important areas of modern health technology, digitized health, is that we're now making it possible for average people to have in their homes devices that are very accurate and can measure various biometric data that's important in tracking your health and predicting possible problems down the line in the future so you can do early detection of disease and other conditions. This is called health self-monitoring. Some of the kinds of things that you might do when you'd go for a clinical checkup at your doctor's office or at the hospital, but you can do these in your home: blood pressure, weight, body fat, blood sugar levels, all those kinds of things. So what's happening is there's a lot of products that are available now and even more coming on the market all the time. And they're connected devices that allow you to store your data and then share it with healthcare professionals like physicians and so forth. And it's changing the way that we're managing our health these days. A company called BCC Research recently published a market report on this health self-monitoring technology market. And they show that this market is going to grow from $20 billion this year to over $70 billion in 2022. So in 5 years, we're talking about a $50 billion growth in the market. That's about a 28% annual growth rate, which is very attractive and very healthy. So there's going to be a big growth in this market. These devices are going to become more and more commonplace. In fact, in my opinion, we're going to see health insurance companies and employers issuing these to employees and customers in the insurance programs to help track their health and be more proactive in terms of identifying problems before they become serious so they can get treated earlier, have better outcomes, save everybody money, and we end up with better health and a better quality of life. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Our constant reminder to listeners each week is backup, backup, and of course, backup. As part of backup, it's more than software and it's more than hardware. There's also power. And I've asked Marty Winston to explain in greater detail the differences between a UPS system selling for $20 and a UPS system that sells for $200. And there's a lot of options in between.
You know that a lot of my segments about the 40-year house project, that's 40yearhouse.com, are involving power and backup, also surge and lightning protection and that kind of thing, because I'm trying to keep it on the computer and electronics side for you guys. And Hank just got something interesting in that he's reviewing. It's a CyberPower under $200 true sine wave automatic voltage regulation, GX1325U. We'll get into why that's important, but he asked me, gee, Marty, explain how UPSs are different. Explain what the different kinds are. And I told him, you don't have that much time. So let me get really down to the simple stuff here and deal with some things that I think will make sense. I'm going to take you back to the 70s. I did a magazine article in the 70s for a magazine some of you will remember called Popular Mechanics. And the article was on how to build your own UPS. Pretty primitive, I'll grant you. But I took an automotive battery charger, a car battery. The editor insisted on adding a drain board underneath just in case. And a 12-volt inverter that had 110 come out. Now, inverters in those days worked a lot like buzzers, pretty square wave, but there was not that much that made a difference to equipment. So square wave could power a lot of stuff, and here was this thing, and you plugged it all together, and it really, really worked. Amazing. I only bring it up because, by the way, in today's jargon, that was a continuous online double conversion UPS. I'll explain all that in a couple of minutes. Every UPS is dealing with the same three things. Now, there are variations. We'll get into those. But the same three things, and it's a best starting point I can think of. Power comes in. Power gets stored. Power goes out. That's what they're all about. Power comes in. Power gets stored. Power goes out. So how does the power come in? Well, for most of the UPSs you and I will deal with, the power is coming in through the AC power lines. And it's going into some kind of a circuit, and this is true for every brand, that charges the internal battery. Sometimes you can expand that battery. That's just a variation that's available. And the battery, when the UPS needs to deliver power, which is all the time for some models, and only when the power drops for others, we'll get into that as well, is generating something close to a natural AC waveform. Now, I say something close. Some are a lot closer than others. There's true sine wave. Woo, woo, woo. True sine wave is that smooth roller coaster kind of thing you saw in math class and all the science fiction movies. And there's stepped sine wave, which sounds more like if you were to listen to it, although it's 60 hertz, so it's the stepped sine wave is an approximation. It's simulated sine wave. You go up a little bit, and you hold that voltage, you go up a little more, you hold that voltage, you come down to that other high voltage, and you hold that, you come down to zero, you keep it at zero for a little bit, then it goes down because the sine wave's going to go down below zero for that same kind of half step, and then it goes down to the full step and holds that for a while, comes up to half, back up to zero. So it's boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, and it's that kind of a sequence of steps, like stacking Lego blocks together. So we've got a couple of things that are a little different going in, but, you know, we're still somewhere around 1980 with the tech, so let's ratchet it up just a little bit. A good power supply today, the kind that's going to charge the battery, is going to do everything possible to not be on at all unless the battery needs charging in every UPS design but one. Get into that. What are the designs? The designs are like this. Remember, power goes in, you got the battery, power goes out. And I said that that simple thing we did with the car battery was double conversion, continuously online, because there was no switching. It didn't care if the power was on or off. When the power was on, it charged the battery, and the battery always ran the inverter. When the power was off, the battery ran the inverter, at least till the battery ran out. Today, there are standby supplies. Standby supplies are not really, I mean, once the battery is charged, it's just going to maintain the charge. Other than that, they're not on. They're just not on. They're not creating the output. When and if the power fails, or if it falls below some kind of trigger voltage, when the power fails, it switches into that circuit really, really quickly. On average, typical units, 4 milliseconds. Now understand that the gear that's getting powered, by and large, certainly the older gear, can handle 17 milliseconds, one power cycle, 1/60th of a second, before it really is aware that the power's not there anymore. So switching in 4 milliseconds is absolutely fine, and if it's seeing that the power's gone at the plug and it switches itself on and switches its plug that your gear is plugged into to be powered by its inverter, or I'll get into that in a second, then the gear still is getting power. Just immediately switched from passing the power through from the power line to generating power from the battery in the unit. Is it sine wave? Is it stepped? That depends on how you order your UPS. One way or another, power is getting through. Now, I mentioned that if the voltage gets too low, the thing's going to kick in. And that really is going to take a bite out of the remaining power in the battery, isn't it? So AVR, automatic voltage regulation, and there's another jargon word for that, line interactive. AVR UPSs have an auto transformer or buck boost circuitry or something of the sort so that the outlet voltage, the AC voltage coming out the plug, stays at or very near the nominal 110, 15, 20 volts, depending on how you interpret that. 117 in some places, but it's staying near that nominal value, even if the power on the line gets a little high, 135 volts maybe, or a little low, down to 90, 80, 85, depending on how that works. In the summer, you got a lot of power demand. There are brownouts that can live down at 90 volts for an unfortunate amount of time. But the auto transformer automatically adjusts the ratio of the power transformer in the unit, so the gear getting plugged into the UPS is getting the right voltage without the UPS having to turn on. AVR, line interactive versus plain standby. There is also, and of course, the option of sine wave, real true sine wave, or a stepped simulated sine wave coming out. There are also continuous online UPSs today, and those are more sophisticated than in days of yore. It is a really, really efficient charger for the battery. It's a really, really optimized battery because that battery is 24/7 full-time powering all the outputs of the UPS. Now, what's important about that is that the battery-powered generator or signal synthesizer, oscillator in some cases, the source of the sine wave output, and those are all sine wave, the source of the sine wave output looks like a very clean power line, much cleaner than what you've got at the plug at the wall. It's right at the nominal voltage. It's right at the nominal frequency. It's pure, clean power. It's like buying bottled water at the AC socket. It's that much better than normal. That doesn't mean the battery's getting charged by something that nice. So you have very adaptive charger circuits in those, more advanced technology than usual. Of course, these are among the more expensive UPS products in anybody's product line. Continuous online, also called double conversion, because it's converting once from AC to DC to charge the battery, and a second time from DC to AC to power the gear. Continuous online, double conversion, jargon, jargon, jargon. If you're on a generator, one of the advantages of double conversion is there's never a phase mismatch. If you're on a generator, when the generator kicks in, the phase of the power coming out of the generator can be just off, just slid down the scale from the phase of the power it's replaced. And that can lead to too much power or too little power on the line. That happens again when the generator gets to turn off because line power is back. If you have a generator, continuous online sine wave UPS double conversion, your best choice. If you have a modern system with a PFC, Energy Star power supply, built anywhere in 2009 on, you want sine wave output. You don't want anything else. You want sine wave output. If you have, an ideal circumstance where the power never sags, you don't need AVR, simple standby will work. For most, I would suggest as a minimum, a line interactive UPS. Some gear is okay with stepped, some gear is okay with sine. Read the sites, read up on it. I think that's all I want to say for now, other than to repeat what Hank always says. Backup, backup, backup. Back to you.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, July the 27th. Their presentation will be Troubleshooting Your Computer 101, and the meeting time is 7 p.m., Middletown Library, Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on drones Thursday, August the 3rd, 7 p.m. They'll meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, room 101 in White Plains, New York. The Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, August the 8th. 7:15 p.m. is the meeting time, and they'll meet in the Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club has its general meeting Thursday, August the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building, room 411, located at 31 Washington Place, and that's in Manhattan, New York. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. Keep on computing, and remember, backup, backup, and of course, backup. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station next week.